Chapter 64. The next day was an outrage upon men and horses both. It was another 13-hour stretch, including an hour's spooning. It was over the barrenest chalk hills, and through the baldest canyons, that even Syria can show. The heat quivered in the air everywhere. In the canyons we almost smothered in the baking atmosphere. On high ground, the reflection from the chalk hills was blinding. It was cruel to urge the crippled horses, but it had to be done in order to make Damascus Saturday night. We saw ancient tombs and temples of fanciful architecture carved out of the solid rock high up in the face of precipices above our heads, but we had neither time nor strength to climb up there and examine them. The terse language of my notebook will answer for the rest of this day's experiences. Broke camp at 7 a.m. and made a ghastly trip through the Zebdana Valley and the rough mountains, horses limping, and that Arab screech owl that does most of the singing and carries the water skins, always 1,000 miles ahead, of course, and no water to drink. Will he never die? Beautiful stream in a chasm, lined thick with pomegranate, fig, olive and quince orchards, and noon an hour at the celebrated Balaam's Ass Fountain of Fija, second in size in Syria, and the coldest water out of Siberia. Guidebooks do not say Balaam's Ass ever drank there. Somebody been imposing on the pilgrims, maybe. Bathed in it, Jack, and one. Only a second ice dash water. It is the principal source of the Abana River, only 1/2 mile down to where it joins. Beautiful place, giant trees all around, so shady and cool, if one could keep awake. Vast stream gushes straight out from under the mountain in a torrent. Over it is a very ancient ruin, with no known history, supposed to have been for the worship of the deity of the fountain or Balaam's Ass or somebody. Wretched nest of human vermin about the fountain, rags, dirt, sunken cheeks, pallor of sickness, sores, projecting bones, dull, aching misery in their eyes and ravenous hunger speaking from every eloquent fiber and muscle from head to foot. How they sprang upon a bone, how they crunched the bread we gave them. Such as these two swarm about one, and watch every bite he takes, with greedy looks, and swallow unconsciously every time he swallows, as if they half fancied the precious morsel went down their own throats. Hurry up the caravan. I never shall enjoy a meal in this distressful country. To think of eating 3 times every day under such circumstances for 3 weeks, yet it is worse punishment than riding all day in the sun. There are 16 starving babies from 1 to 6 years old in the party, and their legs are no larger than broom handles. Left the fountain at 1 p.m. The fountain took us at least 2 hours out of our way, and reached Mahomet's lookout perch, over Damascus, in time to get a good long look before it was necessary to move on. Tired? Ask of the winds, that far away with fragments strewed the sea. As the glare of day mellowed into twilight, we looked down upon a picture which is celebrated all over the world. I think I have read about 400 times, that when Mahomet was a simple camel driver he reached this point, and looked down upon Damascus for the first time, and then made a certain renowned remark. He said man could enter only one paradise. He preferred to go to the one above. So he sat down there, and feasted his eyes upon the earthly paradise of Damascus, and then went away without entering its gates. They have erected a tower on the hill, to mark the spot where he stood. Damascus is beautiful from the mountain. It is beautiful even to foreigners accustomed to luxuriant vegetation, and I can easily understand how unspeakably beautiful it must be to eyes that are only used to the god-forsaken barrenness and desolation of Syria. I should think a Syrian would go wild with ecstasy when such a picture bursts upon him for the first time. From his high perch, one sees before him and below him a wall of dreary mountains, shorn of vegetation, glaring fiercely in the sun. It fences in a level desert of yellow sand, smooth as velvet and threaded far away with fine lines that stand for roads, and dotted with creeping mites we know are camel trains and journeying men, Right in the midst of the desert, is spread a billowy expanse of green foliage, and nestling in its heart sits the great white city, like an island of pearls and opals gleaming out of a sea of emeralds. This is the picture you see spread far below you, with distance to soften it, the sun to glorify it, strong contrasts to heighten the effects, and over it, and about it a drowsing air of repose to spiritualize it, and make it seem rather a beautiful estray from the mysterious worlds we visit in dreams than a substantial tenant of our coarse, dull globe. And when you think of the leagues of blighted, blasted, sandy, rocky, sunburned, ugly, dreary, infamous country you have ridden over to get here, you think it is the most beautiful, beautiful picture that ever human eyes rested upon in all the broad universe. If I were to go to Damascus again, I would camp on Mahomet's hill about a week, and then go away. There is no need to go inside the walls. The prophet was wise without knowing it, when he decided not to go down into the paradise of Damascus. There is an honored old tradition, that the immense garden which Damascus stands in was the Garden of Eden, and modern writers have gathered up many chapters of evidence tending to show, that it really was the Garden of Eden, and that the rivers Pharpar and Abana are the woe rivers, that watered Adam's paradise. It may be so, but it is not paradise now, and one would be as happy outside of it as he would be likely to be within. It is so crooked, and cramped and dirty that one cannot realize that he is in the splendid city he saw from the hilltop. The gardens are hidden by high mud walls, and the paradise has become a very sink of pollution and uncomeliness. Damascus has plenty of clear pure water in it, though, and this is enough, of itself, to make an Arab think it beautiful and blessed. Water is scarce in blistered Syria. We run railways by our large cities in America. In Syria they curve the roads so, as to make them run by the meager little puddles they call mountains, and which are not found oftener on a journey than every 4 hours. But the Ivers of Pharpar and Abana of Scripture mere creeks, run through Damascus, and so every house and every garden have their sparkling fountains and rivulets of water. With her forest of foliage and her abundance of water, Damascus must be a wonder of wonders to the Bedouin from the deserts. Damascus is simply an oasis, that is what it is. For 4,000 years its waters have not gone dry or its fertility failed. Now we can understand why the city has existed so long. It could not die. So long as its waters remain to it away out there in the midst of that howling desert, so long will Damascus live to bless the sight of the tired and thirsty wayfarer. Hot old as history itself, thou art fresh as the breath of spring, blooming as thine own rosebud, and fragrant as thine own orange flower, O Damascus, pearl of the east. Damascus dates back anterior to the days of Abraham, and is the oldest city in the world. It was founded by Uz, the grandson of Noah. The early history of Damascus is shrouded in the mists of a hoary antiquity. Leave the matters written of in the first 11 chapters of the Old Testament out, and no recorded event has occurred in the world, but Damascus was in existence, to receive the news of it. Go back as far as you will into the vague past, there was always a Damascus. In the writings of every century for more than 4,000 years, its name has been mentioned, and its praises sung. To Damascus, years are only moments, decades are only flitting trifles of time. She measures time, not by days and months and years, but by the empires she has seen rise, and prosper and crumble to ruin. She is a type of immortality. She saw the foundations of Baalbek, and Thebes, and Ephesus laid. She saw these villages grow into mighty cities, and amaze the world with their grandeur, and as he has lived to see them desolate, deserted, and given over to the owls and the bats. She saw the Israelitish Empire exalted, and she saw it annihilated. She saw Greece rise, and flourish 2,000 years, and die. In her old age she saw Rome built, she saw it overshadow the world with its power, she saw it perish. The few hundreds of years of Genoese and Venetian might and splendor were, to grave old Damascus, only a trifling scintillation hardly worth remembering. Damascus has seen all that has ever occurred on earth, and still she lives. She has looked upon the dry bones of 1,000 empires, and will see the tombs of 1,000 more before she dies. Though another claims the name, Old Damascus is by right the Eternal City. We reached the city gates just at sundown. They do say that one can get into any walled city of Syria, after night, for bucksheesh, except Damascus. But Damascus, with its 4,000 years of respectability in the world, has many old fogey notions. There are no street lamps there, and the law compels all who go abroad at night to carry lanterns, just as was the case in old days, when heroes and heroines of the Arabian Nights walked the streets of Damascus, or flew away toward Baghdad on enchanted carpets. It was fairly dark a few minutes after we got within the wall, and we rode long distances through wonderfully crooked streets, 8 to 10 feet wide, and shut in on either aid by the high mud walls of the gardens. At last we got to where lanterns could be seen flitting about here and there, and knew we were in the midst of the curious old city. In a little narrow street, crowded with our pack mules, and with a swarm of uncouth Arabs, we alighted, and through a kind of a hole in the wall entered the hotel. We stood in a great flagged court, with flowers and citron trees about us, and a huge tank in the center, that was receiving the waters of many pipes. We crossed the court, and entered the rooms prepared to receive four of us. In a large marble-paved recess between the two rooms, was a tank of clear, cool water, which was kept running over all the time by the streams that were pouring into it from half a dozen pipes. Nothing, in this scorching, desolate land could look so refreshing as this pure water flashing in the lamplight. Nothing could look so beautiful, nothing could sound so delicious as this mimic rain to ears long unaccustomed to sounds of such a nature. Our rooms were large, comfortably furnished, and even had their floors clothed with soft, cheerful tinted carpets. It was a pleasant thing to see a carpet again, for if there is anything drearier than the tomb-like, stone-paved parlors and bedrooms of Europe and Asia, I do not know what it is. They make one think of the grave all the time. A very broad, gaily caparisoned divan, some 12 or 14 feet long, extended across one side of each room, and opposite were single beds with spring mattresses. There were great-looking glasses and marble-topped tables. All this luxury was as grateful to systems, and senses worn out with an exhausting day's travel, as it was unexpected, for one cannot tell what to expect in a Turkish city of even 250,000 inhabitants. I do not know, but I think they used that tank between the rooms to draw drinking water from. That did not occur to me, however, until I had dipped my baking head far down into its cool depths. I thought of it then, and superb as the bath was, I was sorry I had taken it, and was about to go and explain to the landlord. But a finely curled and scented poodle dog frisked up and nipped the calf of my leg just then, and before I had time to think, I had soused him to the bottom of the tank, and when I saw a servant coming with a pitcher I went off and left the pup trying to climb out, and not succeeding very well. Satisfied revenge was all I needed to make me perfectly happy, and when I walked into supper, that first night in Damascus I was in that condition. We lay on those divans a long time, after supper, smoking narghilis and long-stemmed chibiks, and talking about the dreadful ride of the day, and I knew then, what I had sometimes known before, that it is worth while to get tired out, because one so enjoys resting afterward. In the morning we sent for donkeys. It is worthy of note that we had to send for these things. I said Damascus was an old fossil, and she is. Anywhere else we would have been assailed by a clamorous army of donkey drivers, guides, peddlers and beggars, but in Damascus they so hate the very sight of a foreign Christian that they want no intercourse whatever with him. Only a year or two ago, his person was not always safe in Damascus streets. It is the most fanatical Mohammedan purgatory out of Arabia. Where you see one green turban of a Hajj elsewhere, the honored sign that my Lord has made the pilgrimage to Mecca, I think you will see a dozen in Damascus. The Damascens are the ugliest, wickedest looking villains we have seen. All the veiled women we had seen yet, nearly, left their eyes exposed, but numbers of these in Damascus completely hid the face under a close-drawn black veil that made the woman look like a mummy. If ever we caught an eye exposed, it was quickly hidden from our contaminating Christian vision. The beggars actually passed us by without demanding bucksheesh. The merchants in the bazaars did not hold up their goods and cry out eagerly, "Hey, John, or Uchis, Hoaji." On the contrary, they only scowled at us, and said never a word. The narrow streets swarmed like a hive with men and women in strange oriental costumes, and our small donkeys knocked them right and left as we plowed through them, urged on by the merciless donkey boys. These persecutors run after the animals, shouting and goading them for hours together. They keep the donkey in a gallop always, yet never get tired themselves or fall behind. The donkeys fell down and spilt us over their heads occasionally, but there was nothing for it but to mount and hurry on again. We were banged against sharp corners, loaded porters, camels, and citizens generally. And we were so taken up with looking out for collisions and casualties that we had no chance to look about us at all. We rode half through the city and through the famous street which is called Straight without seeing anything, hardly. Our bones were nearly knocked out of joint, we were wild with excitement, and our sides ached with the jolting we had suffered. I do not like riding in the Damascus streetcars. We were on our way to the reputed houses of Judas and Ananias. About 1800 or 1900 years ago, Saul, a native of Tarsus, was particularly bitter against the new sect called Christians, and he left Jerusalem and started across the country on a furious crusade against them. He went forth reaping threatenings and slaughter against the disciples of the Lord. And as he journeyed, he came near Damascus, and suddenly there shined round about him a light from heaven. And he fell to the earth, and heard a voice saying unto him, "Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me?" And when he knew that it was Jesus that spoke to him, he trembled, and was astonished, and said, "Lord, what wilt thou have me to do?" He was told to arise and go into the ancient city, and one would tell him what to do. In the meantime his soldiers stood speechless and awe-stricken, for they heard the mysterious voice, but saw no man. Saul rose up and found that that fierce supernatural light had destroyed his sight, and he was blind, so they led him by the hand and brought him to Damascus. He was converted. Paul lay 3 days, blind, in the house of Judas, and during that time he neither ate nor drank. There came a voice to a citizen of Damascus, named Ananias, saying, "Arise, and go into the street which is called Straight, and inquire at the house of Judas, for one called Saul, of Tarsus, for behold, he prayeth." Ananias did not wish to go at first, for he had heard of Saul before, and he had his doubts about that style of a chosen vessel to preach the gospel of peace. However, in obedience to orders, he went into the street called Straight. How he found his way into it, and after he did, how he ever found his way out of it again, are mysteries only to be accounted for by the fact that he was acting under divine inspiration. He found Paul and restored him, and ordained him a preacher. And from this old house we had hunted up in the street which is miscalled Straight, he had started out on that bold missionary career which he prosecuted till his death. It was not the house of the disciple who sold the master for 30 pieces of silver. I make this explanation in justice to Judas, who was a far different sort of man from the person just referred to. A very different style of man, and lived in a very good house. It is a pity we do not know more about him. I have given, in the above paragraphs, some more information for people who will not read Bible history until they are defrauded into it by some such method as this. I hope that no friend of progress and education will obstruct or interfere with my peculiar mission. The street called straight is straighter than a corkscrew, but not as straight as a rainbow. St. Luke is careful not to commit himself. He does not say it is the street which is straight, but the street which is called straight. It is a fine piece of irony. It is the only facetious remark in the Bible, I believe. We traversed the street called straight a good way, and then turned off and called at the reputed house of Ananias. There is small question that a part of the original house is there still. It is an old room 12 or 15 feet underground, and its masonry is evidently ancient. If Ananias did not live there in St. Paul's time, somebody else did, which is just as well. I took a drink out of Ananias's well, and singularly enough, the water was just as fresh as if the well had been dug yesterday. We went out toward the north end of the city, to see the place where the disciples let Paul down over the Damascus wall at dead of night, for he preached Christ so fearlessly in Damascus that the people sought to kill him, just as they would today for the same offense, and he had to escape and flee to Jerusalem. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.